Hello, Catskills and everyone everywhere. I am Nell Thomason Ribault, birth and rebirth doula, and your host with Catskill Mountain Dreamer on WIOX Community Radio. Together, we explore the reality we collectively and individually participate in, created by the quality of our thoughts and actions, and join nuanced discussions and And that's how it's going to go today at WIOX Community Radio. Things are a little rickety. So I was saying enjoy eclectic music as well. And you just heard Arjun K. Verma with Blossoming. How appropriate on this beautiful sunny spring day. Arjun K. Verma was a homeschooling student, studied with Ali Akbar Khan and a son of the late Roop Verma. And today I have with me Dr. Larry Pilevsky, and I'm going to read his bio first. Dr. Pilevsky is a New York State licensed pediatrician who utilizes a holistic approach to children's wellness and illness. Dr. Pilevsky received his medical degree from the New York University School of Medicine in 1987, completed a three-year pediatric residency at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City in 1990, and served as a pediatric fellow in the ambulatory care outpatient department at Bellevue Hospital, New York City. From 1990 to 1991. Since 91, his clinical experience includes working in pediatric emergency and intensive care medicine, inpatient and outpatient pediatric medicine, neonatal intensive care medicine, newborn and delivery room medicine, and conventional holistic and integrative pediatric private practice. Dr. Pilevsky is a past president of the American Holistic Medical Association. He received his pediatric board certification in 1990 and passed his pediatric board recertification exams in 97, 2004, and 2011. So, and his current pediatric practice, that's what we're going to be talking about. I have a few experiences with him because Dr. Pilevsky was our pediatrician before my children aged out and before we moved upstate. And I can tell you it's a very different visit from the usual, you know, where you feel like you're just being processed, like you're in a factory. You're in and out in 10 minutes. And usually it revolves around vaccinations, those visits. And it's quite different with Dr. Pilevsky, isn't it, Dr. Pilevsky? And hi.
Hi, Nell. Nice to talk to you again. Pediatric practice has evolved in different ways over the years. I mean, I was trained by pediatricians who had practiced in New York City since the 1940s all the way up to the 80s and 90s. And they demonstrated something that was very vital for medical care, and that was being present and being in front of the patients, listening and hearing the stories of the parents, of the grandparents, and watching the kid, taking notes just by observing the child. And over the years, I have, in a fun way, been able to hone the skills of what they taught me way, way back in the early 80s and 90s. But I'm afraid that, sadly, we are having a time in medical care where a patient comes in, you say one word, and they send you for a test, or they send you for a referral, or they send you for blood work, and there's very little time spent with parents or with patients. And what parents have definitely shown me is they value the presence, they value the listening, and they value the time that you can take. And certainly the insurance model and the hospital model and the current medical model don't favor spending time with patients. It's more production, results, get them in, get them out, and how many kids did you see today? How many tests did you do? How many referrals did you make? And to me, that's not medicine at all.
So what is medicine to you? That's a broad question.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, I was fortunate to have trained during a time when medicine was taking a good history, listening, observing, trying to ask the right questions to understand what may have been going on with the child, and then doing a physical exam. And even when I trained in the 80s, it was understood that if you didn't get 95% of your answer, or 95% of the time, your understanding of what was going on with the child could be explained by the history. And if you didn't already have that, then you didn't take the right history. And so what we were trained to do was go through all the possible causes, all the possible contributing factors, all the possible things that might have contributed to the onset of the symptoms in the child, whether they're acute symptoms or chronic symptoms. And nowadays, as a patient of mine said sometime in 2025, when her son was hospitalized for wheezing, and she approached the hospitalist and said, "You know, don't you think it's important for us to try to understand why my child is wheezing all the time? I mean, we can't seem to figure it out." And the doctor said, "Yeah, it doesn't matter to me, because it won't change the kind of medical care that I'm going to give to him." Huh. And so therein lies the problem is, you know, medicine has become symptom resolution or symptom fix, or here you have a pain, here's something to take. Not, let's understand why these symptoms are happening. What's contributing to these symptoms? Anything new in your diet? Anything new in the home life? Anything travel? Anything with supplements or medications? Any stressors at home? Did school change? Has there been a death in the family? Was there a new baby in the family? How's your child sleeping? How are the bowel habits? How are his personality traits? You know, looking at all the factors that go into what contributes to a child's life and trying to understand how those factors brought you to the child that you're looking at in front of you. And modern medicine just says, nah, none of that's really important. We just need to get you in, get you out. You have belly pain. We don't even need to have a, we don't even need to feel your belly. We don't even need to take a history. We just need to get the MRI or the CAT scan to see what's going on in your belly. And that's not medicine.
No.
That's some kind of recipe or cookbook that doesn't make any sense to me, especially doesn't make any sense to parents who are looking for the doctor to listen to them.
What were you able to do for this child with that history?
With what? If the kid had belly pain?
No, the child that you were talking about, right? The parent came to you? Am I understanding correctly?
No, I'm just talking about kids in general. I wasn't specifically naming a child who I saw.
Okay. So, anyway, so you would take a history and then go from there.
Well, let's say a kid came to me and had abdominal pain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I would want to know, when was the last bowel movement? What is the child eating? What is the child drinking? Is the child passing gas? Where is the pain? Is there any trauma? Any medications or supplements? And then you look at the schedule of the child. Is the child doing too much? Is the child sleeping? You know, these are, you know, what's going on at home, any changes in the home. These are things that are necessary for you to understand. And modern medicine doesn't want to understand. They just want to, you know, fix the pain. And for a child who has pain and you're not looking at the underlying cause, you're just going to send them home without any real results.
Yeah, the child's going to be stuck in a vicious cycle. That's at least what happened to me the first 11 years of my life. That's what happened. Vicious cycle. Just keep going back to the specialist. Keep basically getting tortured. until I said, no more. No more of that. Because that's not helping. And we have the capacity to self-heal. We have that innate capacity.
Yeah, but, you know, if you look at the teachings of Western medicine, there is no incorporation of the body has the innate capacity to heal in the way it's practiced. So, right. You know, if you were to, you know, if you were to look at a physician or surgeon or an internal medicine specialist and say those words now, oh, the body has the innate capacity to heal, they would look at you, they might not even regard you anymore. They might completely dismiss you and tell you, you know, you don't know what you're talking about, or, you know, oh, that's woo-woo stuff, or none of that makes any sense. But again, you know, their comment doesn't mean they're right. Their comment just means that's their experience.
That's their training.
But it doesn't mean that that's all of experience. Doesn't mean that's the only experience to have in the world. And that's you know, that's some of the problems with the way Western medicine is practiced. And it's unfortunate that patients who are becoming, especially kids, who are becoming much more complex in their medical issues, there are fewer and fewer doctors and fewer and fewer moments taken to actually sit with a kid and try to really figure out how to help a child. And, you know, that's the trail I've been trying to blaze for almost 30 years, which is, how do we get to the root cause? How do we understand the contributing factors? How do we understand who these children are, other than their symptoms? What's contributing to them on a body, mind, and spirit level? Because you can have 5 kids with asthma, and one kid is wheezing because the kid has food allergies that no one's described. Another kid is wheezing because there's mold in the environment. Another kid is wheezing because the kid has pet allergies. Another kid is wheezing because there's a strong emotional component to the child's life. And then another kid is wheezing because the kid is very sad, or, you know, they've been traumatized. Yeah. And these are things that, therefore, the treatment would be different if you wanted to help the child not wheeze anymore. And what the Western medical doctor would say is, I don't care. Let me just fix the wheezing so the kid can breathe again. And they're willing to send the kid back to the home in the same environment without caring whether you could change the course of a child's wheezing at all. And that's why it's so hard for me as a medical doctor, because when I see kids with autism or I see kids with ADHD, it's rare to find 2 kids who are the same, even though they have the same diagnosis.
Yes.
Because their character, their environment, their makeup, their diets, their parents, their ancestry, their home environments, their contributing factors may not be the same. And modern medicine will tell you, I don't really care. I don't really care. I don't care. We need to sedate the kid, or we need to make the kid sleep, or we need to stop the wheezing, or we need to give something for the pain. I don't care what causes it. I don't care what contributes to it. Let's just find the drug or the test that's going to tell us what's wrong and get the kid out of here. Right. And I just don't understand that anymore. I don't understand. Even when I was an ER physician, or even when I worked in a neonatal ICU or a pediatric ICU, I still was I was taking care of the emergency, but I was still trying to understand, whoa, what got us here? What is it that got us to this place where this kid was expressing this level of symptoms that you wouldn't ordinarily see in a child who was healthy?
Well, I remember the first time I came to your office that you spent 90 minutes with us.
Wow.
Just educating us on what holistic health was in your point of view.
Mm.
And also, of course, I would say a lot of the time was spent that way. And of course, you were spending time listening to find out who we were and why we were there. So,
That was how long ago now?
That was, I think that Max was 3 years old at the time. So 22 years ago.
22 years ago. There you go.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I found you through Holistic Moms Network in Oyster Bay. You were a guest speaker there, and I said, that's our pediatrician right there. That's him. Finally. Because I had gone to pediatricians that claimed they were holistic, and then they weren't.
Wow. Well, you know what's so interesting, Nell, is that I still practice Western medicine. In fact, the foundation of my work is Western medicine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the way that I take a history, in the way that I evaluate children, in the way that I listen and examine, and the way that I look for, you know, what's, you know, physiologically or biochemically going off in the body. But I just don't use the pharmacological or vaccine tools because, yeah, here we're back to the first statement we made, which was that I understand that the body does have the innate potential to heal. And my job as a clinician is to provide an opportunity for healing, not necessarily an opportunity to suppress the symptoms.
There you go. And so we were spending a great chunk of the time, of course, in order to maintain health and achieve health. Nutrition is a very important factor.
Well.
And so do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what it was. I mean, it was 1983. I was 22 years old. And I was this, you know, brand new medical student going off to become a doctor. And the first day of medical school at the end of August or beginning of September of 1983, the dean of the medical school gets up to welcome the class of 1987. And I don't know what made him say what he said. And I don't know what made me remember what he said. But he said within the first 10 seconds of welcoming us, nutrition is not a field of medicine. And I just found it really odd. You know, saying that nutrition is not a field of medicine is like saying the liquid that you put in the tank of a car has no bearing on whether the car will run or not.
You know? Yeah.
So you can fill that tank up with anything you want because it's not related to the health of the car or to the running of the car. And I had no real understanding of nutrition when I was just 22. I mean, I knew what made me fat. I knew what made me not fat. But, you know, I was a kid. I was a baby.
Right.
And so when he said that, nutrition is not a field of medicine, it just stuck in my head. And then over the years, as I started to realize what role nutrition did play in the health of the body, I thought, wow, we're in one of the greatest cognitive dissonant environments of our lifetime because it was truly, truly, truly practiced that regardless of your heart disease, regardless of your cancer, regardless of your asthma, regardless of your joint pain, regardless of your neurological symptoms, regardless of your lung symptoms, regardless of your belly symptoms, regardless of your skin symptoms, you can eat whatever you want.
Right.
And then when diet did become an issue, what was it that became the biggest thing about diet? Oh, just eat low fat.
Right.
Which was one of the biggest scams in nutritional history.
Yep.
Because of how much the body needs fat, craves fat, and has to have fat in order for optimal function. And then to describe what kinds of fats they are. And then, you know, we look back and we see, if we go into the literature, we find that the literature on eating a low-fat diet was actually influenced by industry to convince people that they needed to eat low-fat to stay healthy, or they needed to eat margarine instead of butter, or they needed to eat partially hydrogenated oils. And it was industry that actually formed the national opinion. And with that came the increase in sugar content in our diets. And with that rose the obesity epidemic. And, you know, the way modern medicine works is, you know, let's create a problem. And I know it might stir some of the listeners. What do you mean, let's create a problem? Well, you know, there's a concerted effort in a large portion of those who control the medical system to create health problems, because then they can actually provide you with drugs that will fix your health problems. But it really will never fix it, because it's not meant to fix it. It's meant to keep you on the drugs forever and ever and ever so that they can make money. But they don't want you to know that the kinds of food you eat could influence your wheezing, your tonsil size, your skin, your abdominal pain, your neurological symptoms, your joints. They don't want you to know that.
Exactly.
And so that takes a lot of willingness to accept that you as the patient, you as the consumer, are obligated to take care of yourself without waiting for your doctor to tell you what's right or not. Because the sad part is doctors still don't know much about nutrition. And even though RFK Jr. has gotten the medical schools to agree to 40 hours of nutrition for every medical student, it remains to be seen what that entails.
For sure.
And how or if that actually gets incorporated into clinical practice.
Right.
Because it's one thing to learn it, but if you don't know to incorporate it into your clinical practice, what's the use, really?
Right. And then, the food pyramid. That I remember that was one of the things that you addressed right away at our first mm-hmm. visit.
Yes.
Like, you know, who created that food pyramid? And how inappropriate is that actually?
I mean, you know, what most people are, you know, and this has a lot to do with willful ignorance, meaning I just don't want to know. And it has to do with the fact that people don't want to be told that what they want to eat isn't good for them. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we are a culture of addictions on many levels. And again, I understand it. I'm not judging it. I understand it. And it is hurting us to maintain such a level of, if I don't eat that, I will die. You know, which is very, you know, unnerving, you know, to watch, you know, the population not have the education, not have the discipline, and not have the support to be able to say, do you realize that if you say, if I don't eat this, I'll die, that you're actually hurting yourself by saying that. You know, I want a 13-year-old boy who came to me with an old diagnosis of PDD-NOS, which is pervasive developmental disorder. And he was on the autistic spectrum, and he was 13, and he, you know, the mom wanted him to get better. And of course, the medical community says, "What do you mean get better? You're not going to get better. This is the way he's going to be." And I gave the child some hope. And the way I did gave hope was, I said to the kid, "You know, after taking your history, Joey, it looks to me as if you remove gluten, you might get better." And he looked at me and said, no, Dr. Larry, there's no way I'm going to do that." And I looked at him and I said, "You know, it's really interesting, Joey. Sometimes when people are told that they can do something to make themselves better, they look at me and say, 'Really? Do you think that's going to help me? Do you think I'm really going to get better? Well, if that's going to make me better, I'll try it.'" And he looked at me and he saw what I was doing. And he said, "Okay, Dr. Larry, I will try it." And he tried it. And the next visit he came in, maybe 3 or 4 months later, before he even said hello to me, he walked into my office and said, "Dr. Larry, I just have to tell you that I changed the diet and I got rid of gluten and I got so much better."
That's great.
And, you know, I don't know if it was gluten or if it was wheat. Mm-hmm. Or if it was gluten and wheat, if it was glyphosate, if it was the genetic modification of the organism, I don't know.
Right.
I know that this boy had an experience of getting better. And no one could ever take away his knowledge because he saw it happen. Now, what he chose to do going forward is completely up to him.
Right.
But he had the experience. And no one could take that away from him. Modern medicine would say, "Oh, that's luck. That's not. It was just lucky." Modern medicine would rarely say, "Oh, wow, maybe food does affect your health."
Yeah. To a certain degree, I think when they look at diabetes, they have an idea about sugar, but not really.
Well, I'll tell you, in the late 1990s, I participated as a volunteer for the American Diabetic Association to help them run an event to raise money. And I just got involved. I don't know what was going on at the time in my life, but I volunteered, and I put together an entire party fundraiser for the American Diabetic Association. And they raised money, and it was around that time that the American Diabetic Association came out with a statement that said, "It doesn't really matter what type of sugar you eat or how much sugar you eat, because you can control it by your insulin levels and checking your blood sugars." And I never did anything for the ADA, American Diabetic Association, again, because to me, that was malpractice.
That's a betrayal.
It is.
Yeah. And,
but, you know, that's how industry takes over and tells you, it doesn't matter what you eat. It doesn't matter what kind of sugar you eat, because we can help you by making you take a certain amount of insulin so that you can control your blood sugars. Not to mention the fact that sugar is an empty nutrient, that sugar is an inflammatory agent, that it increases your autoimmune process, that it adds fat to your diet, it adds fat to your body, because eating sugar creates laying down of fat in your body, and that sugar actually dumbs down your brain because it preferentially selects for the reptilian part of your brain, and it compromises the higher brain centers, which are the brain centers that tell you to think. And so this was in the late 90s, and I just thought, wow, this is betrayal. You said it correctly.
Yeah. Wow. I'm glad to hear you talk about the reptilian brain. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, when humans are born, the majority of our nervous system development occurs outside the womb, whereas almost all mammals have the majority of their nervous systems maturing in the womb of their mom. And so we are born with a very primitive brain as humans. And one of the terms of the, you know, primitive brain is that it's a reptilian brain, meaning it's a very fight or flight, emergency, knee-jerk, primitive reflexes, very, very trauma-based, adrenaline-based, emergency brain reaction to the world. But that's not the brain that we're meant to continue to live with as we grow older. So the maturity of the brain requires that we get out of our reptilian brain, that we get out of living through emergencies, out of living through danger, out of living through fear and fight or flight and panic and adrenaline and dopamine. And so the human brain, when it develops from babies onward, is to send nervous system messages from the back of the brain, which is where the reptilian brain resides, towards the middle and the front of the brain. And that's what creates an emotional body. That's what creates a mental body. That's what creates a thinking body. That's what creates an aware body. And if we don't allow babies to mature properly, meaning if we don't allow them to explore and to examine and to investigate and to try and to experiment, if we don't allow them to have experiences and to fail and to struggle, if we don't allow them to learn from their mistakes on their own with our guidance, then brain development either slows or stops. And the unfortunate thing in our culture is that we introduce kids to a lot of things in the environment and in the diet that actually prevent forward brain development from happening.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is in the foods that we eat. A lot of that is in the pesticides and the chemicals and the plastics that we're exposed to, and the air pollution and the geoengineering. But most of that is from the injections that we give to children through the entire vaccination schedule,
yeah,
including pregnant women when they go for prenatal care.
Thank
and
you for saying that.
All of this endangers the well-being of the brain and endangers the well-being of the development of the brain up from the reptilian brain towards the more prefrontal and frontal cortex, which distinguishes us as humans over every other mammal.
Yep. And I'm so glad that you mentioned that, too. What's being done to pregnant women now, they scare them into also taking more boosters, because apparently mm-hmm. what they were given in childhood expires. So, you know, it's not really immunity then, is it?
Well, again, I mean, we could spend a couple of days
yeah.
just talking about the whole, you know, vaccination schedule. I think the challenge in our culture is to be willing to say, is there something I don't know? Is there something that I've given up my agency to, such that I trust an authority outside of me that's telling me something that may not be right? And, you know, most people who are anti-vaccine now are anti-vaccine because they were pro-vaccine.
Yeah, because they, you know, or they just were going through the motions. They were not necessarily for or against, but like me, I went, you know, I didn't really want to vaccinate my children, but I also thought, you know, I was vaccinated, I was okay, and I thought I had to do it in order for my kids to go to school. And I have definitely come around to say no.
Right.
No more. And when you see just the amount of vaccinations too, it's just Yeah, not something that I would ever want to do to any child, and certainly not my own. So, yeah,
well, again,
and my children were harmed. Two of them actually experienced vaccine harm. So,
right.
And it, it takes a lot to clean that up, to detox from all of that.
Think about a parent who went through all the vaccines and they are hearing what you're saying and they then have to wonder, wait a second, is she right? No, there's no way she could be right. I vaccinated my kids and they're fine.
Yeah, they're just fine.
And that's the question is, are they really fine?
Yeah.
And people don't know how to identify what a vaccine injury could possibly even look like. And that's because they have to recognize that vaccine injury happens at all. And the modern medical community, the media, the government, the medical, you know, agencies will all tell you that there's no such thing as a vaccine injury. Or it's very rare.
That's right. So, and right. It's really kind of cool to be neurodiverse and, you know, so that's not an issue, except when it is, when your child is wearing a diaper through adulthood, it's an issue. When a child is nonverbal, it's an issue.
Right, but you know that you know, for the parent, I mean, I have to tell you, there are parents where the kids are not speaking and the kids are wearing diapers for their whole entire life,
yeah.
And the parents still insist that the vaccine had nothing to do with their child's condition. So you still have that, you know.
Yeah.
The problem is for the parents who really understand that they themselves put their child through a procedure that might have destroyed their child's brain forever. And that's a large pill to take. So
yeah, it's a responsibility eventually that you parents who eventually are on the other side of that question and look at it honestly, they most of the time really feel very guilty, which also doesn't help.
Right. But I will tell you that those mothers and those fathers who do get through the guilt and do get through the rage, because, you know, let's not forget how angry they get.
Yeah.
They often will put their guilt and their rage into action, and that action will propel them to do everything they can to help their child heal. And as you know, the modern medical system doesn't think there's anything called healing from, any neurodevelopmental disability. So they will, you know, admonish these parents and tell them that they don't know what they're talking about and that they're wasting their time and their money. You know, let us just give your kid drugs and you'll be better. And the parents are finding out unfortunately, that's actually not how their children are going to get better.
Eventually, they do. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you are a parent who believes that your child was, in fact, injured from a vaccine, and you know that you've been gaslit for years because no one will recognize that what you're saying has any merit, because they can't. It's not that they won't, but they can't. Because then they have to admit that they were part of a process that may have done the same thing to their own children, or that a doctor may have been part of a process that injured children. And it is a big comeuppance. It's a big awareness that happens when physicians and parents actually realize, oh my God, look at these ingredients. Look at what's in this shot. Look at what happened to my child. Look at what is getting into the brain of my child. What did I do? And
yeah, you know, I want to tell you about the MMR, for example. I thought I had to give that to my child in order to go to school. It, you know, I didn't really know about homeschooling, that you could do that. You know, I was kind of freshly here. I came here in 91, and my first one was born in 94. So, and I grew up having the measles and the mumps, and it was non-eventful. Right. So mm-hmm. I said, why would we want to? I don't want to take those shots. I don't want them to. So. So, yeah, that's where I was at. So I was already questioning, and I did see the result eventually.
What did you see as the result? No.
So, and I didn't recognize it right away. I heard from other parents what happened to their children. Right. So. So what happened to my child was he was given the MMR, and the next morning I was asleep, and he woke me up by headbutting me and breaking my nose.
Oh,
and
wow.
Then I saw him headbutting the bedboard and the floor, and I called the doctor. I said, something is very wrong, and the doctor said, no. You know, and I saw that he had a fever, and no, it's normal. He's probably having a headache. Yeah.
Right. So you're a parent.
Oh, and explosive diarrhea.
You have a toddler.
All of that. Okay. Yeah.
What'd you say?
Explosive diarrhea, too.
Yeah. So you're a parent, and you have a child who's a toddler who goes to the doctor and gets the MMR and starts headbutting you, breaks your nose, has explosive diarrhea, and your doctor says that's normal.
Mm-hmm.
So you could see the cognitive dissonance.
Yep.
You know, here's a mom who knows her child better than anybody, who has never had a child of hers headbutt before, and have this level of explosive diarrhea. And you go to a medical provider and say, something's really wrong with my son.
Yes, and I waited, by the way. I waited until I was done breastfeeding. Okay, I even waited. I delayed, you know.
Right.
So,
yeah. But yet, this is a child who had never expressed such symptoms. And other than the MMR, there was nothing that would have instigated such a display of symptoms, and the doctor still said, not, it's normal. This is just normal stuff that happens. And you as a mother have to walk away going, maybe he's right. You know, maybe this is normal pediatric behavior, and maybe it has nothing to do with the vaccine. Even though, as you later learned, when you open up the package insert, you recognize that there are ingredients in the MMR vaccine that directly go into the brains of our children.
Right. Right.
And eventually
you learn that, but I didn't know that at the time, right? I saw the pamphlet, I didn't see the insert, and it's weird because I always was trained in the Netherlands by my general physician who also practiced homeopathy. I was always taught, look at the insert. And I didn't think to do that with the vaccines.
Right. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, if you read the package insert, it does say, you know, that there are nervous system damages that can happen after an MMR.
Well, I have since really read the inserts, and I've seen that it can actually cause
encephalitis.
Not just encephalitis, yes. That is definitely the thing. That's what my son experienced. That's what I know now to be true. But also the atypical measles. That's also funny. You know? And all the list of things that they scare you with is all on there.
Right. And it's interesting that you mentioned that it can cause atypical measles.
Yeah.
You know, when there are measles outbreaks in the country, As everyone who actually watches or listens to the news, the comment that is made almost 100% of the time is that the measles outbreak was because of unvaccinated kids. And they never, even though you just read from the package insert that the vaccine can cause a presentation of measles, they never, ever, ever engage in a dialogue that opens the possibility that the outbreak could have occurred not from an unvaccinated child, but from the fact that the vaccine may have spread the measles. And this is tragic because they're just denying the science that they put out. The science that they put out is being denied.
Yeah.
For the sake of an agenda that blames the unvaccinated kids. And the irony is that the vaccine itself doesn't even work on everybody who gets it. So you essentially have a large percentage of kids who get the MMR for whom the vaccine is not working. And so they are essentially unprotected. And so they're just as likely to cause an outbreak as anybody else.
Of course.
Again, we do not include this in the dialogue, which should tell people something, that there's an agenda going on here. Because science says, it's right there in the package inserts, the vaccine can cause measles in the population, and it is ignored. Anytime you see an outbreak, it is ignored, completely ignored.
Yep. Yes, it's always the same story. And that's all it is. It's a story.
Yeah, but, you know, unfortunately, it's a mythology that is very dangerous to vulnerable people who, you know, for whatever reason, choose to trust rather than to question. And you, as a mother, had no choice but to question because of what you saw happen right in front of you.
Right. And also, I didn't really want to do it, okay? There was a part of me that said, don't do this.
Interesting.
And I felt pressured into it because I was brand new in this culture and I thought I wanted to fit in. Well, I don't think that anymore.
Well, it's interesting, Nell, because you tell a story that over 30 years I've heard over and over and over again, which is that a lot of mothers and fathers went into the pediatrician's office and really felt wrong about giving the shot.
Yep. I eventually walked out.
And went ahead and did it anyway.
Yeah.
And those are the children that the parents report were most injured. They knew in their gut, don't do it, don't do it.
That's right.
And they got influenced to do it.
Yeah.
And they suffered because of it.
Okay, so parents who decide they do not want to do this, in New York right now, they don't have much of a choice in terms of going to a school. On the other hand, there are a lot of homeschooling co-ops in New York as a result of that, because there are plenty of parents here in New York that are saying, nope. That's not the way. That's not how I want to raise my child.
Right. I mean, it's a mixed bag now because you get a lot of parents who can't homeschool in their minds.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean they can. It just means with the information they have and the knowledge they have about homeschooling, it's just not possible for them and their family. Even though with the right guidance and the right research and the right support from the community, if they ventured into the learning stages of it, they might find that they could do it and that it might work for their child, and that socialization will happen, and that your child will spend less time actually learning and more time developing as a human being. And, you know, we have lost in our culture, we have lost the importance of developing young children as human beings. Instead, what we're doing is developing them as students. And what the homeschooling community is really trying to show is how much the homeschooling curriculum is helping to develop kids as human beings with emotional intelligence. And what we're finding in schools today in our culture is that there's less emphasis on emotional intelligence and more focus on, you know, repeating and answering and just doing what you're told to do. And, you know, there's an agenda behind that because it does disable children from being critical thinkers. But homeschooling for other families, you know, some families choose to move out of a state where there's no freedom to go to school. And some children, you know, have to, some parents just bite the bullet and they do give their kids the shots. And the thing that I say to parents is, I can't guarantee that your child will be the same child once you give the child the shot. I can't.
And,
I don't,
yeah,
I don't
right.
know.
And you're one of the pediatricians who's just going to have to outsource that because you're not willing to do that, right? Because you practice.
I haven't offered vaccines in my office in almost a quarter of a century, and because I took an oath of first do no harm.
Thank you.
And I recognize that there is great harm in the injection of these shots. And if parents want the shot, they can go and get it from another pediatrician.
Exactly.
I don't stop them at all.
No.
I just let them know that it's not a practice that I can engage in. I can't.
Yes.
Because of what I know and what I've seen.
And thank you for that. You are the only pediatrician that I know personally that actually still is practicing according to the Hippocratic Oath, and I am forever grateful that you were our pediatrician and helping many others live healthy lives. And I'm going to have to leave it here, unfortunately, because Rosina is here of Various Voices. She's coming up at 2 p.m. And I do want to mention that everyone who wants to learn more from Dr. Pilewski, you can hear him on his weekly podcast, Critically Thinking with Dr. T and Dr. P, on Thursday evenings at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and can listen to more of his podcasts and interviews by visiting drpilewski.com. And Pilewski is spelled P-A-L-E-V-S-K-Y. drpilewski.com. In about, hopefully in 2 weeks, I will have a podcast available and a link to it that I will send you, Dr. Pilewski, so you can also put it on your website. And I will link your website into that as well.
Great. Thanks, Nell. It was great reconnecting with you.
We love you, Dr. Larry.
Love you, too. My regards to the boys.
Thank you.
Take care.
You, too.
Somebody